welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Andrew Heaton, and the interior of your car is so clean. How do you keep it that clean? Very tidy person, that's what I think. If you look up at the night sky on a clear evening, you can see about 2,000 stars. I can see about 2,500 because I eat a lot of carrots. You can see about 2,000. That's just a fraction of the stars in our galaxy, which number somewhere between 100 billion and 400 billion. Let's say there are 200 billion stars in our galaxy. Now let's take a conservative estimate of how many of those might have sun-like stars, and then take a fraction of those, just 1%, that might have life, and then just a fraction of those that might have intelligent life. After taking a sliver of a sliver of a conservative estimate of the amount of stars that have planets, we're still left with 10,000 intelligent species that ought to inhabit our galaxy. Now consider that our planet is relatively young and girlish, a mere 4.5 billion years old. But as you get closer to the galactic core, stars and planets get much older, upwards of 12 billion years old. So presumably, if there is other intelligent life in our galaxy, some of it is much, much older and more advanced than we are, even Canada. And that begs a rather troubling question, doesn't it? If there are 10,000 intelligent species in the galaxy, and lots of them are literally millions of years more advanced than us, how come none of them are listening to my podcast? Or if they are, how come they aren't leaving reviews? To temporarily divorce me from this equation, another question might be, why haven't aliens swung by Earth to say hello and be neighborly? Or how come we're not picking up their awesome sitcoms by now? That notion, that if there are thousands upon thousands of aliens out there, why don't we know about them, is what's known as Fermi's paradox, and it's what my producer Jennings and I are going to talk about today. But before we do that, we do have to pay those bills, and that means a word from our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Invisible Car Keys from Wunderkim Industries. If you're like me, you're sick and tired of people stealing your car. Whether it's sneaky neighborhood kids, a wayward valet, or just your run-of-the-mill car thief, people steal my car 3 or 4 times a week. I've done everything I can to keep people from stealing my car. I leave a note on the dashboard that says, please don't steal my car. Sometimes I even call my more suspicious friends, specifically Evan Sims. And out of the blue, I'll just say, you better not be thinking about stealing my car, friendo. Fortunately, there's a great new product on the market, Invisible Car Keys. They're like regular car keys, only they're completely transparent, like little pieces of jingly glass. Sure makes it hard for sneaky old Evan to steal my car keys when he can't find them. Now that said, if you're like me, you sometimes forget where you set your invisible car keys. Did I leave them on the dresser, maybe on the couch? Where are those things? Well, in that case, you can purchase a strobing neon keychain that will help you spot those pesky transparent keys. Just attach your strobing neon keychain and you'll be able to spot those keys from an acre away. Invisible car keys from Wunderkim Industries, the industry leader in hiding car keys. My guest today is a man about town, man's man, ladies man, friend to all dogs, producer of my show, 2008 times person of the year. Was that right? I can't remember which was the year that they gave it to all of us.
Yeah.
Whatever that one was. 2008. Yeah. There was a lot of different things. The man, the myth, the legend, Josh Jennings, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Did you have to travel far to get here?
I sure did. I walked all the way across the hall.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. It's not easy to do.
I am excited to talk to you about the Fermi paradox. This is one of my favorite topics. This is my favorite.
Yeah, mine too.
This is my favorite topic. It happens less now that I'm in my 30s, but like come 1 a.m. when you're at the party and about like a third of the people have left and you're like, have a drink, want to talk to you about something. What I'm saying, gentlemen, is this is the deal closer. bring this one up to prove how smart you are. But like the Fermi paradox, I'm honestly kind of freaked out by it because the first time I encountered it, I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about it. And I just sort of assumed that there was a kind of Star Trek universe out there where we're all more or less climbing out of the ooze within a 300-year period of one another. And then when you get to thinking about it, no, if there are intelligent species, then there are presumably intelligent species that have been around a couple billion years, and they're not swinging by to say hi. And that's kind of disturbing to me. So I'll tell you my fear with it, because there's a theory called the Great Filter Theory. And the idea is that there's some cataclysmic event that just naturally happens in every civilization where either the point at which we can develop atomic weapons, just every civilization blows itself up, right, or point at which you can develop Cylons, all the Cylons turn into hot platinum blondes and kill everybody.
Is honestly probably the best way to
which
go.
Which is, if we were going to pick a way to go,
right,
100%, I'd want there to be hot Cylons living on the moon or something. But it does make me, that's my fear with this scenario, is that it's basically the absence of evidence is an indication that evolution, in the same way that every human culture will eventually develop the wheel, if given enough resources and time, every sentient civilization eventually blows itself up. That's my fear. Are you worried?
I'm not particularly. I've given a lot of thought to the Fermi paradox, and I actually found some rather comforting news, which is that the Fermi paradox is probably neither Fermi's nor a paradox, which I'll get to that in a second.
Wait, hold on. If it's not Fermi's paradox, I don't feel any better. If it's Bob's paradox, I'm like, oh, it's Bob?
Yeah,
Bob's full of crap. I don't care now.
But that's just it. Bob's an idiot. I'm not worried if an idiot thinks that we have an empty universe. I'm a little more worried if somebody like Enrico Fermi thinks that we have an empty universe.
Bob's a chump. Go on.
Bob is a chump.
Yeah.
Screw Bob.
Yeah. Unsubscribe to my podcast, Bob.
That's,
you know,
right,
who you are.
We don't need you. But anyway, to go back to your question, I'll come back to that in a second. I do think that that something in what you're saying there is worth noting, which is that we only have our civilization to go on. We only have it for purposes of comparison.
And Belgium.
I mean, if you want to count them as a civilization.
Yeah. Shots fired, Brussels.
I guess they gave us waffles, sort
of. Yeah.
to go back to the paradox itself, first of all, as I understand it, and I think there are multiple different versions of this story, so, you know, take this with a grain of salt. The conversation in question that everybody always references about Enrico Fermi and friends is
that... Which was a great sitcom.
It was
great
a
variety
great
show.
Sitcom.
It came right after Carol Burnett, yeah, as I recall. Enrico Fermi,
yeah,
and friends.
It was great until they added the laugh track. And
yeah,
then,
that was terrible. Then it sucked. Just hokey.
The conversation supposedly did indeed take place, and Enrico Fermi did indeed say at some point, where is everybody? Mm. Which probably we should outline that part for the listeners who are not familiar with the Fermi paradox, which is that supposedly Enrico Fermi and a group of other physicists were talking at lunch one day, and someone had seen a cartoon of an alien coming out of a spaceship, and they started talking about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life. And by the way, this is like 1950, so this wasn't as big of a thing in the public consciousness as it is now. Apparently Enrico Fermi at one point spoke up and said, "Where is everybody?" And the maybe myth that follows that is that from there he postulated what's known as the Fermi paradox, which is essentially
why haven't all these civilizations come by to say hello,
right, or any of them
be neighborly,
not just all of them,
any of them.
Why have,
yeah,
none of them, yeah,
space Belgians swinging by to give us space waffles.
It's according to what I've read, that didn't actually happen. The Fermi paradox as we know it today is a combination of observations by Michael Hart in 1975 and Frank Tipler in 1980.
I feel no way better.
Well, I'm just throwing it out.
No, but that's good. I'm more inclined to
look at the reasons why it's not a paradox.
Okay.
And why I don't think it's
You're getting meta. I like that.
Yeah, I don't even think it's a viable.
I want to pause you because I don't want. I want to build up the suspense. Because I've got my conclusion to this. I know you've got your conclusion to this. So let's walk through some of the scenarios first, and then at the end of it,
okay,
you and I will put out what our theories are. So Fermi's paradox, to reiterate what it is, it's basically the idea that if intelligent life can arise in the universe, there should be a bunch of it, and it should be older than us. And so why haven't we talked to it yet? That's weird. That's me putting a cap on it. So there's kind of maybe four broad categories for why this could happen. And this is a fun mental exercise to go through. So I've already mentioned the great filter theory. And that's the and I went through two specific scenarios: the awesome Cylon theory, where platinum blondes that are just smoking become the dominant form of life.
Again, the favored way to go.
Yeah, favored way to go. The other one is that we nuke ourselves, in which case maybe we're okay. Maybe the moment that should have killed all of human civilization was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Maybe we got through it. If in theory, if every civilization gets to that nuclear breaking point, there should eventually be one civilization that breaks the mold where they've got a moon that doesn't have uranium on it, and there's a bunch of astronauts that are stranded there. So there might be some civilizations able to break it. There's another possibility as well, that the great filter, this event that stops intelligent civilizations from happening, actually happens very early. It could be that life develops with some regularity on other planets, but that jump from unicellular to Belgian is very, very unlikely.
Thag is carving a stone rock one day, and the next day he finds plutonium.
Right. maybe it's that. Maybe that they're like, we get to the level of chimps, or we get to the level of apes, but it's just very unlikely. So that's a possibility. But most of the great filter theories are disturbing, because most of the great filter theories are they would indicate that we're due, or that we will be. Yeah. And that when we're dead, no one's coming to come find our cool stuff. We're just dead, right? So that's the most dark.
By the way, that part is the thing that I fear. I'm not terribly afraid that the universe is empty. That I don't think that's probably the case. I do worry a bit that our self-destructive tendencies as a species. I'm going to sound like a Roddenberry liberal here. Our self-destructive tendencies as a species may outpace our technological advancements to the point that we do destroy ourselves before we can colonize Mars, or we can move out into the cosmos.
In which case we'd appear to be in that stress period right now, because we have nukes.
We do, yeah. Nukes are definitely a very worrisome thing.
To put it on a potentially better note, though, if we get out of the great filter theory, there's an idea that there are a ton of civilizations out there. The most conservative estimate would be about 10,000, if we're going with the 1% kind of stuff.
Sure.
That they're dark. So it could be Stephen Hawking, before he died, said that he thought it was a very bad idea to try and reach out and broadcast our location to other civilizations, because we don't know who they are. And it was kind of his position that that would be like, the people in the Yucatan Peninsula trying to make contact with Spain. Maybe don't raise attention to the gold we have, or whatever it is. And so,
but the Spanish brought them Christianity
and smallpox and all sorts of other things. Yeah, there's lots of things that they brought them.
They were very kind.
Yeah. And I'll throw out real quick, that is one thing that I don't have a lot of traction for when I get into science fiction, is I like the Independence Day conceit that civilization would have the ability to travel the galaxy, but then needs to come to Earth for 10 or something, is just to me mind-bogglingly bad economics. That would be like the equivalent of, we found petroleum on Mars, so we're going to try to get to Mars so that Halliburton can drill for petroleum. The amount of money that you need to get there, it wouldn't make any logical sense.
But maybe they weren't coming for 10, though. I mean, they never specified. Maybe it was they have Dairy Queen.
Could be. But there is this dark theory, and so in that one, and this one's more optimistic, because it could be the one that just all these civilizations that they basically get to the Stephen Hawking level of brilliance and go, we should shut the F up.
Right.
And just not broadcast our location, because we don't know what's out there. So it could be that happens naturally. It could be that they just have super good porn or something else. I'm putting a funny hat on it, but there is a theory that basically when a civilization gets intelligent enough, that civilization develops the Matrix.
Maybe they have non-murderous Cylons.
Oh, nice. Yeah, right. So they're like, why would I go around the galaxy? I got my Cylon buddies here, one of whom's a 9-foot-tall blonde model. Could be. So it could be that basically we get to that civilizations, this is sort of like the positive corollary to the great filter, that we get to a point where we can make our own universe that's so cool that we just don't want to go out beyond. We don't want to leave the house. We're in our pajamas. Right. We're in our Snuggie. We've got the electric blanket. We've got Netflix. We don't want to leave the house, right?
It's the great quilter.
The great quilter theory. Oh, that's great. I am writing that down, Jennings. The great quilter. You just got yourself a Nobel Prize. And then I suppose probably another variant of that would be the prime directive. Right. Which would be that there is some sort of galactic intelligence, whether it's connected or not, but that there's sort of an acknowledgement that they're not, that there's some sort of quarantine state that we're put into.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think those are all plausible. Well, I think that they are, they're interesting. Whether the plausibility, again, I think that given that we only have our own species to go on and our own ability to formulate an idea of what a civilization of beings would even look like, what that structure would look like, would it necessarily form in the same way ours would, or even in trying to imagine one that doesn't form itself in the way that ours has, we're still just kind of, I think, mostly producing negative images. Not negative as in bad, negative as in like the reverse, the mirror image of ourselves.
Yeah, inverted images of Earth.
So I think that's very limiting. Much like the idea of you know, we're going to take the 1% of the 1% and use that as our possibility. I understand you have to do that for you know, the purposes of trying to come up with something semi-realistic. But the truth of the matter is we have no idea. We don't even really, we have no idea how life started here. Mm. We really don't.
No, you raise a really good point. And this is, having not been thinking, I stumbled onto the Fermi paradox maybe 4 years ago. So I haven't been thinking about it consistently for the last 4 years.
It's literally all you talk about.
It's all I talk about. I just talk about this in Scotland.
Yeah.
I think, right, because there are so many assumptions that are built into it that it's virtually impossible to unpack because we can't see what it's like outside of us. So like one example, and this was occurring to me earlier. I'm the Fermi paradox is we're explaining it. I am assuming that life happens naturally at some point, and then eventually it might turn into a civilization which is intelligent. What if there's some factor we're unaware of? For example, let's say that it took about 12 billion years of the cosmos existing before cosmic brain rays were just emitted everywhere, and we can't detect cosmic brain waves because we don't have the technology.
Or we can, and they look like dark energy to us.
Right. But there was some factor that we're unaware of, right?
Sure.
In which case, then the whole equation changes, because at that point, we might be the first civilization. And it may just be that there's some factor we're unaware of. We're only, like, there's, what, 18 dimensions or whatever? We're aware of 5?
Sure.
In Netflix? So, like the you know, it could be that we don't know them. So that's entirely possible. And that goes into like a whole nother category of the Fermi paradox, which is that it's possible that there are civilizations, they've not gone dark, they've not blown themselves up, but we have no idea how to communicate with them.
Right.
Where we're like 2019, we're like, well, clearly the telegraph machine is like, you know, how every civilization would communicate. We've thrown out our line to the world. And we're like, where's the Morse code? I'm not hearing any Morse code here. And it turns out the rest of the universe is all super intelligent space whales.
Right.
And they all communicate through, you know, some kind of Wi-Fi telepathy. And they're just screaming at us. They're like, please stop with the Kardashians. We're sick of this garbage. We just want to hear podcasts. But we can't hear them. So we're going out there going, I can't, there's nothing here. But in reality, we're bombarded with it. We're just completely unaware of it.
Sure. So I came up with a few possibilities as well. I think periodically over millions of years of space travel, you're going to get lost. So like, I think it's entirely possible when you develop this subset of like, well, if I think the Fermi paradox addresses if there was a civilization that had X amount of time, even traveling, I forget if it's at sublight speeds or just at light speed, how long it would take them to basically visit everywhere in the universe. Yeah. And then the assumption from that is, well, since that hasn't happened, you know, then maybe they're not out there. I think you have to take into account multiple things. Like, people are going to get lost. Like, Steve falls asleep at the wheel.
The point at which they're light speed, are they going to get lost? Like, I feel like they'd probably a pretty good star chart to that point.
You would think, but maybe, I mean, things will happen.
The other bomb thing in is, charge.
You're talking about, yeah. Then
Bob,
you're really
Space
screwed.
Bob's the worst.
Yeah,
Space Bob's got his map to Disney World. He's getting lost, circling Disney, or circling Dairy Queen all the time.
But I think you could also, I mean, we're talking generational ships again, assuming that this is life that lives, you know, a similar amount of time to us. It's generational. If you had to do what your father had done before you and he had to do what his father had done before him.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, don't you think at some point down the road, you're going to be like, you know what? I'm going to fly this starship into a sun.
Have you read Dust? Have you read that novel?
I don't think so.
So I won't, I'll make this as quick as I can, but it's a really good novel. And it begins with, there is a nuclear silo. We don't know where it is. Neither do the people in it. And it's like a multi-generational nuclear silo. And they can see, they've got cameras. They can see the landscape around them, which is all nuclear waste. And there's just this mention in the first chapter that at some point there'd been an uprising in this particular apocalyptic silo that had destroyed all the records. And as a result, no one knows how long they've been down there. Like they've got a guess, but like something like that could conceivably happen. You're right. If there were going to be a bunch of multi-generational ships where, like, you know, maybe they don't fly into the sun, but like there is some kind of, like, you know, the Wi-Fi goes out or something.
Or I mean, they decide to go to war with other right. civilizations, yeah. or they decide, you know, this 50 planet grouping is the most that I can handle. And so we're going to settle in here because this is plenty.
You've got like a Dunbar's number.
Where
Like space whales can up to 30,000 contacts, but after that, they don't want any more.
There are so many permutations of available possibilities. And well, and the biggest thing, by the way, this is my last one. The biggest enemy, I think, of space exploration, hands down, is bureaucracy.
Hmm.
Bureaucracy, if it works anything like it works here in any other civilization, it's going to be like, oh yeah, we developed Starfleet, but 80% of our ships are currently on loan for the Klingon Pride parade. We're not.
Have you seen Red Dwarf?
I have seen.
That's a shout out to the British listeners.
Yes, very much.
There's an episode where because the premise is that this guy is put in cryogenic freezing.
It's Craig Ferguson was in that show.
Was he?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Very young Craig Ferguson.
I did not know that. Yeah. In the show, the main character is put in like cryogenic freezing or whatever, and everyone else in the ship's killed by radiation, and he wakes up like, you know, a thousand years later, but he's got a hologram buddy, and at one point the hologram guy is talking to him, and he realizes they hadn't paid his taxes. And the hologram is like, what do you care? Like, Earth's been dead for a thousand years. And he's like, that's not going to stop the tax service.
Yeah.
He's like, I've had like, oh, this is, I'm going to reveal my inner dork here. Jennings has seen the inner dork a number of times, but I don't know that the audience has. I like having daydreams. I have like, I have like maybe four or five set daydreams that I will just do on like whenever I'm jogging. And one of them is that for whatever reason, aliens come down.
Is this
going
to involve Cylons?
No, it won't involve Cylons. No, I'm not telling you anything about that fantasy. But in this fantasy, like, aliens come down, and they're like, hey, Andrew Heaton, come meet us at this park. And I'm like, oh. And in this fantasy, I always bring my passport because I'm like, there's probably some bureaucrat on that ship that's got to stamp my friggin' passport. So I've always got, even in my fantasy, I've got to do that. I want to back up a little bit to the earlier point that I think you make a very good point on, which is that we're only operating off of our understanding of civilization. We could be wrong about it. So if we go back to this idea that a civilization could be a billion years older than us, which is so hard to comprehend, if we were the equivalent of kitchen ants in Patrick Stewart's kitchen, like, Patrick Stewart doesn't care.
It's further apart than that.
Right. You think about what a billion years. I mean, it could be that there's some megastructure, some multidimensional megastructure that we're just completely unaware of, and they don't care about us. We don't care about them.
Right.
And let's hope that they're not going to install a blender or something.
If you want to go really weird, I think it's possible. Not saying I think this is likely. I think it's possible that that interstellar bodies may have some sort of distributed intelligence. It sounds wacky.
No, they'd be like neurons. Basically light would be like photon packets would be like neuron bursts.
It's possible. Yeah.
In which case the galaxy
would be
intelligent.
If you were an atom inside of a human brain, you'd have no idea that anything was going on other than just neurons moving around.
Interesting, yeah. So there could be intelligent, like macro intelligences.
Absolutely.
Which makes sense. I mean, like my gut fauna has no idea what I think about Patrick Stewart.
Yours might, but everybody else's
my,
doesn't.
Mine might. My gut fauna.
Your gut fauna is very well aware of your Patrick
Stewart. I've said it often enough now that the gut fauna is like, oh my God, we get it. He's a knight that was on Star Trek. Oh, we just want to digest this bagel. Yeah, I think that's possible. And like a couple other scenarios that are possible. One that two that we've glanced over. One is that we actually, the Fermi paradox is not a paradox because aliens have made constant contact with us and the government has not done it or has not let us know. That's a possibility.
Yeah.
I think an unlikely one, this is where my inner cynic of government efficacy comes up.
Right.
Where yeah. I'm just like, I think it would, like, I feel the same way about the moon landing. I feel like it would be so much easier to go to the moon than to have that many bureaucrats lie about it for that long.
Right, yeah.
And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but if not, I'll make it as quick as I can. But I've met Buzz Aldrin twice.
Right.
And the second time I asked him what he thought about intelligent life, and he had, I think, the same position that we have, which is that statistically it's an almost virtual certainty that there is intelligent life out there. But if it were contacting Earth, it would require a conspiracy of every government to not talk about it, at which point I piped up even France, because I feel like France would eventually want to make us feel bad. And the fact that France hasn't done that to make us feel bad is an indication that that's not there. And then the other
I trust Julian Assange, and there's no question he would have let us know.
Right, he would have let us know. Yeah, good point. And then the other possibility, which you haven't brought up, is that there could be a religious capacity here, or a religious element to this, where maybe God exist, created the universe, and we are the only intelligent life in all of it because it requires an act of God. In which case, I'll say, like, if I'm around here 20,000 years from now and we are the only species in the entire galaxy, I think I would go, I'm pretty sure then that there had to be some kind of maker behind it, because the odds are so odd that we're the only one.
Right.
That happened, that there might be some intelligent design behind this.
So if it turns out we're not in a simulation, if it isn't the case that beyond, say, the realm of our solar system, all the stars are just, you know, digital projections that we're seeing, you know, that are there for our own benefit or something like that. I do think that it's very weird to think take it from a theistic point of view for a moment. Let's say God creates the whole universe and only puts life on Earth. In the span of time that we're going to be here, whatever that is, whether it's 10,000 years, a billion years, it's unlikely that we're going to branch out and explore the entire universe. I mean, the universe is expanding. We have to take that into account.
Yeah. And we're not, in this whole podcast, we've not even mentioned other galaxies, of which there are many.
Oh,
there's a lot of them. There's over 12.
There's at least 13, I think.
They discovered
a new one.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if that's the case, why? Why is it out there? Why did he create it? I mean, those stars don't look that different from the more local stars.
He loves swirls.
He
really loves swirls. People don't know that. He just loves swirls.
What's the point? Why? Why have a universe that is expanding outward, that is so vast we can't even begin to really grasp it? If you're not going to people it with put other life out
you raise
there.
A good point, but you raised another good point, which is, I think
that's really all I do is raise good points.
You. The you mentioned simulation, which I think is another alternative to the Fermi paradox, which is that we are actually living in a simulation, and this would require another drink and another conversation. But there are a lot of smart people who think that we're living in a computer simulation, and the quickest way to do this, I think, is to say, let's say that a proper quantum computer is made. Right now, the computer that you're listening to this on via your phone or via your computer or whatever is relying upon a binary system, right? Ones and zeros. A quantum computer would be ones and zeros and also one and zero simultaneously, and also these various combinations, which makes, as I understand it, basically processing power at our current station, it would appear to be infinite. Even though it would not be, but it would appear to be. And also the memory capacity would appear to be infinite. So the point at which you read a headline that says, quantum computer makes simulation of Earth. If you ever read that headline, if that ever happens in the course of your life, quantum computer makes realistic simulation of Earth or indistinguishable simulation of Earth. Let's say that. If it's a quantum computer, there's no reason that there couldn't be 1,000 simulations of Earth. And at that point, if there's 1,000 simulations of Earth that are indistinguishable from the simulation that we're living in, you have to logically infer the likelihood that you're in the real Earth is pretty low.
Right.
And so there's a possibility that we're living in, I don't know, a video game, or that there's, you know, the Cato think tank in the real universe just runs simulations constantly and go, what would happen if Dan Quayle hadn't been president? And that we're living in that, like, turns out a game show host becomes president. That's what happens when Dan Quayle's not president. So that's another possibility.
Yeah, I agree. I think the I obviously you're right. This is a subject for another conversation where we have time to expand that one thing. I do think that simulation theory or a variant of it is probably the most likely explanation for a creationist version of the universe, by which I do not mean
you mean like a like
young Earth creationist.
Yeah, yeah, no, you mean there's some intelligence behind it.
I mean,
it.
Yeah, intelligent design is actually what I meant. I think intelligent design and simulation theory could very well go hand in hand. Whether that's accurate, obviously, I don't know. But I've given it a fair amount of thought, so we'll have to do that at some point.
We're approaching the conclusion of the episode. What is your final take on the Fermi paradox? What's your synopsis of this?
I'm very glad that if what I read is correct, that Fermi didn't take this to the level that we understand it today. That it was a couple of other people I've never heard of, because to me, and we didn't address this, and I'll very quickly address it. To me, it doesn't represent a paradox. It doesn't. It not only doesn't particularly worry me, because I don't think we can wrap our heads around all the different possible scenarios that could explain why we haven't seen life yet. But also a paradox itself, like the notion of a paradox is something like, if I say to you, this sentence is false.
Wait, so it's a grammar? Grammar is what this boils down to for you?
Grammar.
You just have a problem with the grammar of it? Like if it was called the Fermi problem, you'd be fine with it?
Yes, I'd have a better time with it. Yeah, no, it's not a true paradox.
I just had this image of aliens coming down and going, we've got a cure. Like, we are here to blow away the Fermi paradox. And Josh Jennings straddles up and he's like, it's not a paradox. And like, and they're just like, yeah, we got a cure for cancer. And you're like, real quick, hold on, shh. Paradox.
Go back
means
to the
that.
Paradox thing.
Yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned, what we think of as the Fermi paradox, or I like the Fermi problem better.
Yeah.
What we think of as that is simply a failure of human imagination to rise to its full potential, or human imagination. A failure of human imagination that is insurmountable. It's possible we can't actually conceive of the answer to this because we can't wrap our heads around what's actually out there.
Yeah.
In either case, it doesn't really worry me very much. Things like us destroying ourselves through some means, particularly nuclear power, worries me. The heat death of the universe worries me a bit, but obviously I'm not going to be around for it.
We should be gone by then. Well, right?
Probably.
Even if we take fish oil supplements, we'll probably be gone by then.
Really quickly, I'll close out on or leave you with a brief little story from my youth. When I was a young kid, we went to I think it was the Kansas Cosmosphere, and they had this.
Is that in Hutchinson, Kansas?
It sure is. Where
Hutchinson,
we have
Kansas,
listeners.
Where we have listeners. Shout out to Hutchinson, who's greatly outpacing Los Angeles at the moment. Go on. Sorry about that.
That's fine.
Was this whole thing just to plug Hutchinson?
We did this entire episode.
Nice. That's for
just
you.
For you,
that's
Hutchinson.
For you, Hutchinson.
You're welcome.
The Hutch.
The Hutch. When I was a kid, we went to the Cosmosphere. I remember we looked up at the ceiling where they had projected this this film that was talking about the universe as we know it. And at one point, they talked about our sun and what it was composed of, all of this stuff. And they said, and in 5 billion years, it's going to explode. And I remember thinking, because I was very, very young, I remember thinking, oh my God, what if I'm around for that? And I was genuinely terrified. And I asked my parents about it, and my parents are creationists, so they're like, God won't let the sun explode.
Right.
So
nice.
I felt comforted.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I still do.
I'll tell you, my take on this is, while I am bothered by a lot of this, I think one of the factors that's generally left out of conversations about the Fermi paradox is, if we're going to talk about the length of our galaxy's existence and therefore how old the civilizations are, then you also have to make the assumption that they might have already been here 3 or 4 times, right?
Oh, of course.
So if let's say civilizations developed 3 billion years ago, they might have been here 50 times with millions of years in between. And they come back and they're like, still dinosaurs.
Still no Dairy Queen.
Yeah, they come back and they're like, oh, they're different. Now they're dinosaurs with like weird cankle things in the end of their tails. But previously they had horns. Right? Like that, like most of human history is not human, or most of Earth history is not human. Yeah. So I think that's a distinct possibility. And I don't know if you have a civilization that intelligent, I don't know that they'd establish like a permanent star base on the moon just to see if the algae would eventually congeal into something that could make a good podcast.
Sure.
I don't know.
We may be boring.
Yeah, I do not think that for a second. I think that if the interstellar quasi-dimensional Patrick Stewart being is listening, he's probably chuckling right now.
Probably.
And I chuckled throughout. Jennings, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's a good time.
All right, let's go do some karaoke.
Indeed.
Before we leave, let's get some good old-fashioned Homo sapien listener feedback off iTunes. Hood29 says, quirky and funny, Heaton stays on topic just the right amount. Thank you very much. You can watch this whole show on YouTube. If you look for Something's Off with Andrew Heaton, you can see my handsome bearded face, an assortment of suits, and the dead bison head we screwed to the wall. Today, you can even feast your eyes upon my lovely producer. And then notice that I am wearing different blazers at the beginning, middle, and end, and then wonder, is Heaton a replicant? Or did they just pre-tape it? You will not be able to determine that. But you'll be able to see what me and Jennings look like, so that'll be nice, right? Watching Something's Off with Andrew Heaton on your computer will only make you seem more sophisticated and amusing at your office or prison cell. So go to YouTube and start watching full episodes. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage on Earth and throughout the galaxy at large. Thank you and good day.